On this week's 51%, we speak with One Love's Katie Hood about the signs of healthy and unhealthy relationships and how to tell which one you're in.
While not every unhealthy relationship will become abusive, every abusive relationship was once unhealthy. So if we teach about unhealthy behaviors, we're empowering people to understand the things that aren't okay.
Divorce coach Tara Eisenhardt also shares her tips for nursing a broken heart, co-parenting with your ex, and moving forward. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh leader. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. With Valentine's Day now in the rearview mirror, I thought today we'd focus on the different ways relationships can go south. Love is the most important thing in our lives, but recognizing it and navigating our relationships isn't always easy. That's why the federal government recently dubbed February Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, to teach younger and more vulnerable populations what love actually looks like. Our main guest today is Katie Hood, CEO of the One Love Foundation. One Love was founded by the friends and family of Yardley Love, a University of Virginia student who was beaten to death by her ex-boyfriend shortly before her graduation in 2010. Hood says the murder came as a complete shock to the community. No one knew Love's relationship with her ex had been toxic, let alone abusive. But looking back, the signs became a lot more clear. Hood says One Love was created to prevent such violence by helping people recognize the signs of an unhealthy relationship before it escalates to abuse. Their 10 signs of healthy and unhealthy relationships are helpful for everyone, but the foundation specifically focuses on teens and college students. Because again, people can be more vulnerable at that age, but Hood says our first few relationships can have a profound impact on the way we think about love, sometimes for the rest of our lives.
While not every unhealthy relationship will become abusive, every abusive relationship was once unhealthy. So if we teach about unhealthy behaviors, we're empowering people to understand the things that sort of aren't okay, and to not make excuses for them, and to really just, this is what's happening. What am I going to do about it? So we have 10 that we like to talk about. I'll just talk about a few of them. One is intensity. Intensity is, you know, sort of explosive reactions to things, like reactions that are way bigger than what you think someone should react to. So say, for example, you're out with a bunch of friends and you don't answer the phone every time, or you don't answer every text. If your partner explodes at that, that's a very intense response. Like, you as a person should be able to have your time with your friends and not be on call and not be responding to every text or every, you know, outreach from your partner. It could be getting really angry at you for very little things. You know, maybe it's a comment you make to a friend, or to some, you know, comment about someone that you used to date that results in a huge explosion. That sort of intensity, when the person reacts that way, they can sometimes say things like, well, I did this because you did X. So they sort of put it back on you. But intensity in general is not a healthy relationship behavior sign. With intensity, when this happens, what we really want people to do is to be able to say, that felt super intense. Can we talk about this? And really, like, really have the conversation about what caused that and how can we avoid that in the future. One of the ones that I think is the most missed in our like really romanticized view of getting sort of whisked off our feet and finding the person of our dreams and happily ever after is isolation. When you meet somebody for the first time, like, many relationships are exciting. You want to be with the person all the time, but sometimes you do that at the expense of sticking with the activities or the people or the friends or the family that were sort of your lifeline and your source of support before. Now, that's sort of natural at the beginning of any relationship because you're so excited about this new thing. But paying attention to whether you feel like your new partner is actually requiring you to spend time with them and not with others. So, I don't like your friends, your family's against us, really working to tether you to them and not to your support system is just something to pay attention to. It's not just that he loves you so much, he wants to be with you all the time. It's that you, as in a healthy relationship, you have two people that have their independence still and that can keep up their networks and their relationships with people that they had before they got together. Relationships are hard. Like, this is the first thing we should say is that all of us have unhealthy things have been done to us, and we have done unhealthy things. Human beings are complicated and relationships are hard. In healthy relationships, you're able to find a place where you can talk about the things that felt off. I remember in my early relationships, even in my marriage now, it can be hard to figure out when to create the space to say, can we talk about what happened? Because it didn't make me feel good. I didn't feel safe, or I didn't feel secure. Or I didn't feel whatever I didn't feel. It can be really hard to learn how to have that conversation and to know when to have it. But if you have the ability to express yourself and say, like, when you did that, this is how I felt. And they say, well, that wasn't my fault. That was because of XYZ. If they can never own their own role in having you feel this way, that's a really bad sign. Because all of us make mistakes. We shouldn't be afraid to own the mistake and say, you know what? I didn't even think about it that way. I'm going to work on that. Please give me feedback if I ever do that again. So there's just like these little differences in terms of understanding the behaviors that are conducive to sort of building a really trusting partnership that can last versus, you know, a lot of unhealthy relationships have a ton of insecurity in them around how you feel when you're in them or how people are treating you or where you really stand.
Okay, so what about green flags? What are signs of a healthy relationship?
Green flags. I mean, I think that healthy conflict is one of the biggest ones. Conflict is part of every relationship. You know, it can be little conflicts over where are we going to go to dinner tonight, or it can be bigger conflicts like who are we going to spend the holidays with? I mean, there can be lots of layers of different things. I think the ability to listen to each other and to really like understand each other's concerns and work through to a solution. It's something we all like, even if you're not in an abusive relationship, learning to deal with conflict in a healthy way is a really important human skill. I think respect is a really important one, and respect applies to your viewpoints, you know, your decisions, or just your boundaries. And I think that frequently we don't think enough about, I know that in when I'm in a relationship where I feel respected, the amount of security I feel that I can be me and I can do what's right for me in the context of that relationship is pretty significant. And I already talked a little bit about independence, but I really think that the healthiest relationships are two people that love spending time with each other, but they also have their independent lives too, is a really healthy thing for us to think about. We don't want to give up all of the things that we're two individuals together. We don't merge into one person. And if people are, if someone's making you feel like, no, we do everything together now, that may not be so healthy. And it may not over time, let you be the person you want to be.
Any advice for, I guess, setting boundaries in a relationship? If you're not in the practice of doing that, how should you go about doing it?
So the first thing is to really, I think you do have to spend some time with yourself. Like we always say, you got to trust your gut about what feels right or doesn't feel right for you. I think sometimes, I don't want to make generalizations, but I think sometimes women are sort of pleasers where they ignore their gut and they just go with what's being asked of them. And I think learning to develop a healthy belief in your gut instinct and that your gut's telling you what you need is like part one. I think the second is like just viewing boundaries as part of you versus some rule or some law or something that you're putting up. Like a boundary is something about you that is like, maybe it is that you don't like being snuck up on, you don't like being hugged from behind or whatever. That's so silly, but like some people don't. Some people have space issues, and being able to explain that and say like, this isn't like a bad thing, but I just need you to know about me that XYZ. Or maybe some people don't like when you just show up out of nowhere unexpectedly. Being able to talk to your partner and say like, this isn't really about you, it's more about me. Some partners might respond by belittling and say, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That's crazy. That's not ideal. Like you want somebody who'll go, you know what? I'll try to work with that. Like, thank you for letting me know. Here are some of the things that are big deals to me. So I think what we should think about with boundaries is it's sort of a mutual discussion about like where you work best, how you do best. And it's really about in a healthy relationship, I think there's a big enough respect that you can listen to that and try to work with each other's boundaries.
So how do you know when a relationship has crossed over that line from being unhealthy to abusive? You know, aside from like the obvious, if there's like physical or sexual abuse.
It can be really hard for you yourself to know when something has gone from unhealthy to abusive. And I think that's primarily, I've come to believe that it's like human instinct to think that abuse can't happen to us. But the stats are that more than one in three women will be in an abusive relationship in their lifetime, which shows us that that's all of us. I mean, we all know someone. But we call it different things. We call it drama or dysfunction. We don't want to think that it's abuse. So I think that, again, back to trusting your gut. If you understand, I think it all starts with understanding the signs of an unhealthy relationship, these unhealthy relationship behaviors. Pay attention to them. In the earliest days, try to work through them and bring them up. If you find that you have a partner that doesn't want to ever have this conversation, that's a really bad sign. It may not be an abusive relationship yet, but if they're not willing to listen and hear and potentially work on the behavior, probably not going to be a lasting relationship for you. If these behaviors really escalate, that's I think what really happens is they start happening with more frequency. Sometimes these emotionally unhealthy behaviors can become physically abusive behaviors, but it's important to say that even if they never become physically or sexually abusive, emotionally abusive relationships have a longer term mental health effect on people than physically abusive relationships do sometimes. So when somebody becomes exceptionally controlling, or they're following where you're going, or you think they're tracking you, or they're sabotaging you, and they're, you know, doing things online to hurt your reputation or whatever it may be, you may be at a different level in a relationship. And I think that there's a bunch of important things. I think one, the answer is not just break up with a person. The time of breakup is the most dangerous time in an abusive relationship. Abusive relationships are a lot about control and one person controlling another. And when you break that control, that can cause people to go haywire and really extreme things to happen. I think it's really important to start bringing your trusted friends into it. If you're in an abusive relationship, it is likely that at this point, you've been a bit pulled away from your friends and your family, because part of an abusive relationship involves a person tethering you to them and not to the people that you had in your support system before. So it may involve rebuilding some relationships with people or outreach. And it involves making yourself vulnerable and sharing with them what's happening and what your concerns are. There's definitely resources, and we really encourage using those resources. But the most important thing, depending on what your situation is safety planning. Are you safe? What do you need to do to become safe? What's the plan you have for getting out of this relationship? Part of the reason we focus on healthy is our dream is that people leave these relationships before they become abusive, because once it's abusive, it's really challenging. And on average, it takes a person in an abusive relationship 7 times of trying to leave before they actually leave. So, but the important thing is, don't try to do it alone. Don't do it without a plan, and don't be ashamed. The numbers show this happens to almost all of us. And so there's no shame around it. Now it's just about how do you surround yourself with the resources you need to get out safely.
For non-abusive relationships, just relationships on a broader scale, is there a healthy way to break up?
Again, every situation is a little bit different. I think in general, if you from the earliest days of your relationship can develop patterns around healthy communication that mean that all the way along, it's not going to catch anybody by surprise. You've been talking about the issues you're struggling with, or maybe there haven't been that many issues, but you're just not feeling it. My general advice would be that one of our healthy signs is kindness, you know, not ghosting somebody, not just disappearing, but really saying like, where I am right now, like, this is not where I need to be right now. This is, again, if you've built a relationship on the pattern of honest communication all along, it's probably going to come easier than not. One of the dreams is that those conversations become easier. I'm the parent to teenagers. And I always say to them, I wish somebody had told me when I started dating back in the day that the first person I go out with is very likely not the person I'm going to end up with. Like, breaking up is part of relationships. Like, it's not like the worst thing to happen. It's you start dating so you can figure out who should you be with? What do you like in a relationship? What do you need? The whole process, if we could frame it more as you experiment and breaking up is a natural part of it versus this like devastating blow or something you want to avoid, I think it would help recalibrate it for all of us.
Katie Hood is the CEO of the One Love Foundation, which provides young people with the information they need to avoid and escape unhealthy relationships. You can find their full lists of signs for healthy and unhealthy relationships at their website. That's joinonelove.org. They also offer school and community workshops on the subject, and their blog offers teens advice on everything from how to handle arguments with friends to how to know when it's time to break up. Again, that's joinonelove.org. As Katie Hood mentioned, and according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, approximately 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men experience some form of physical violence from an intimate partner. And again, abuse can take a lot of forms that aren't physical as well. Here in Albany, the New York Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence recently acknowledged its 30th anniversary. Launched in 1992, it was the first cabinet-level agency nationwide created to study and guide government policy around domestic violence. Earlier this month, OPDV screened a short documentary on its history to a reception of legislators and survivor advocates from across the state.
The household has become, for many, a house of horrors. The horror is wife-beating.
Well, I think the first was just to have some credibility that this was a thing that happened to them. I mean, when I began, it's hard even for me to sort of believe this now, people didn't even understand. When you said domestic violence, people kind of looked at you, you know? And I can actually remember at a point in time when that phrase became commonplace and, you know, it was no longer a surprise to hear it. But at the beginning, it was like, there wasn't even an understanding of what we were talking about.
Until very recently.
That's Carla DeGirolamo, who first led the agency when it transitioned from its early days as a governor's commission to the formal body it is today. Other guests in the documentary included New York Governor Kathy Hochul, State Senate Leader Andrea Stork-Cousins, and leaders from various women's groups and shelters. As DeGirolamo said, a lot of the agency's early work just focused on getting people to see domestic violence as a legitimate crime worthy of a coordinated government response. Now its focus has expanded to the broader realm of domestic abuse and sexual assault prevention. It remains the only cabinet-level agency in the U.S. dedicated to gender violence, things like stalking, human trafficking, and more. I got the chance to speak with OPDV's current executive director, Kelly Owens, during the reception. She says the agency's approach to domestic violence has changed a lot over the years, too. In the 90s, there was an emphasis on calling the police, but nowadays advocates know that's not always the safest or most effective first step. And survivors often need assistance in a lot of other areas, too.
You know, they're interacting not only with law enforcement and the courts, but they're, you know, it's playing out in schools when a child is affected by it. It plays out in hospitals when somebody comes to the hospital as a result of a sexual or domestic violence abuse situation. It's playing out in housing when somebody is renting a home and there's a fight and somebody gets evicted and all of those things. So it's really looking more holistically at folks that are impacted by this issue.
When we look at the work that you're doing now, and I guess the work for the next 30 years, what's still on the table?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we know is really clear is that somebody's race, somebody's gender, and somebody's sexual orientation can be a barrier to getting assistance. So we're really focused on how to be more inclusive in our system. Why doesn't somebody call the police? How can that person still find safety? So we're really trying to look at how we can be more survivor-centered, trauma-informed, understanding that that person comes to you with not just the incident that they're coming to you about, but the trauma that they bring with it, as well as being culturally responsive and really understanding why somebody may or may not want the assistance that you're offering them.
Given, I mean, there's so many different ways that we should be addressing domestic violence, but is there anything legislatively that you would like to see happen that would help your work?
You know, the governor proposed a change in the model policy, the county model policy that OPDV will lead. Every county has to have a policy in place that shows how they're going to handle these issues at the local level. It used to just address domestic violence. Now it's going to address all forms of gender-based violence, stalking, all of those things. So we're hoping it'll pass. It's really time to look at those systems. Those systems were put in place 30 years ago.
Now, I know every person's situation is going to be different, but if you're someone who has been surviving domestic violence and you're looking for a place to go, are there usually good first steps that a person can take?
Yeah, the first step is probably to call the hotline. We have a state hotline, but there's also local hotlines. And really talk to the person on that phone. They're trained to understand what's your danger level, are you safe, how can they get you safe. That's the first thing you should do. But also, if somebody that you know is experiencing domestic or sexual violence, the first thing you should do is listen to them and really believe them and understand that you may be asking them to do things that they believe will put them in danger. Often somebody says, well, you have to call the police. Well, that's also a time when somebody knows that the abuse is going to escalate. So that might not be the safest time to do this. So it's really understanding that that person knows what's best for them.
I was going to ask, like, how do you start that conversation with someone if you're not sure they're comfortable talking about it, or, you know, you don't know what's going to be best for them, but you're concerned?
No, I think you just really speak from the heart. Say, you know, I'm noticing this. If you want to talk about it, I'm here for you. That's really the way you start it. And if they say, I'm fine, and you say, well, just know that if you're ever not fine, I'm here for you, and we can do this together. They need to know that they have the support, because they've been isolated, right? They've been told that they won't be believed when they come out with their story. So it's just telling them that you'll believe them and you're there for them.
If you or someone you love is experiencing domestic violence, help is available. You can contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE or text START to 88788. As Owens mentioned, the OPDV also has a hotline. You can call 1-800-942-6906, text or chat online at opdv.ny.gov. You can watch the entire 30th anniversary documentary for OPDV on YouTube. And of course, we have links to all of these things, including past episodes we've done solely on domestic violence, on our website. That's wamcpodcast.org. The fact of the matter is that sometimes even healthier relationships, healthier marriages, don't work out. The beginning of the year is actually a pretty big time for divorce. And according to at least one study from the American Sociological Association, women are more likely to file for divorce than men. We've discussed the legal aspects of divorce at length on previous episodes of this show, but what about the human side? Our last guest is Tara Eisenhard, a divorce coach based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Eisenhard is herself a child of divorced parents. She's been an ex-wife and is now a next wife, so she has a lot of experience on the subject, and she wants people to know that divorce does not have to be a terrible, devastating experience. In fact, sometimes it can be good. She particularly serves as a mediator for couples who have mutually decided to go through the process together. But even if you're the one who wants out, she says it's important to talk it out before cutting ties.
Marriages don't break up because everybody's super happy and then somebody just decides one day, oh, I want to end this. And so I always recommend that if you are asking for a divorce, you know, regardless of whether you're, you know, man, woman, whatever, but it's always good to have a conversation and be able to open it up for an open dialogue and allow the other person to share what they're thinking and feeling as well. Because a lot of times the ways that the relationship is broken, even if it's not something that we're talking about, it's something that both sides are feeling. And so it's always a good idea to be able to invite the other person to this conversation and to be able to say, what are you thinking about this? How are you feeling right now? Are your needs being met? And be able to establish that dialogue and then be able to look at a path forward. If people can come to the conclusion together that they would like to move forward on a divorce journey, the divorce journey is probably going to be a lot healthier and more productive than if one person feels that this is just something that's happening to them.
And again, just to point out, we're talking about healthy relationships here, where you can safely make that cut. Divorce isn't necessarily easy for either party, though. As you said, marriages don't end because everybody is happy. So what does the healing process look like? How do you mend a broken heart, I guess?
Right. So the healing process is going to look a little bit different for everybody, but there's some common elements. And the one common element that everybody shares is the grief process. It does not matter if you initiated the divorce or if you were on the receiving end of that conversation. Everybody goes through the stages of grief. So the denial, the bargaining, the anger, the depression, and finally the acceptance. everybody's going to go through that process, and everybody's going to kind of swing between those different stages throughout the process. And it's not just the people who are going through the divorce, it's going to be the family members and the close friends. Everybody who was, you know, attached to that relationship is going to go through their own grief process. So that's always something to keep in mind. And then there's this process of rebuilding, and you really can't let go of this old thing, relationship, attachment, dreams for the future, whatever, you know, that doesn't fully fade away until you have built something and really invested in something else. So there's a lot of effort that people will need to put into their healing journey, into just investing in what this next chapter is going to be and getting the kind of care that they need along the way. I talk a lot about the idea that physical wounds are very much like emotional wounds. And we don't think about it that way. We don't talk about it that way. But if you had a broken leg, you would know that you need to assess the situation. You need to get medical attention. You might need some medication, and you might need some help living your life until that has healed. And it's the same way with emotional wounds. So if you're dealing with an emotional wound, you want to make sure that you are getting the healthy healing process. Make sure that you are assessing that situation, get the medical care that you need, get the assistance living your life that you need, whether that means help with childcare or, you know, having a therapist that you can go and get some emotional support from. Whatever that process looks like, it's really important to do that. If you don't heal in a healthy manner, just like physical wounds, there's going to be some kind of infection or some kind of, you know, bone that doesn't heal right. And then you can't move forward the way that you want to. So those are some common elements there.
How do you navigate that process when kids are in the picture? How should you break the news to your children?
So there's a lot of information out there. And I always tell people that you know your children. You know your children better than some PhD who lives in another country and has never been to your home. And so when you're planning how to tell the kids, be aware of what their unique needs are. There's a concern about how, you know, they might take the news in a certain way. You can kind of plan for that if you know what it is that you're trying to avoid or trying to nurture. It's always great if parents can break the news to their children together to present the united front, because that's really important. It's important because children of divorce will figure out how to play their parents against each other and get what they want. But it's also really important because it sets the tone for the conversation, and it sends the message that you're still family, which is very important. Regardless of where people sleep at night and what somebody's last name is, to children, their parents are always going to be their parents. And that's important to be able to keep that mindset moving forward.
Having kids also brings the added complication of not being able to just say goodbye to your ex and move on. Any advice for handling those issues that naturally come with parenting, but now having to do them with your ex?
Yeah, that can be really hard. The first thing is to start with the way that you identify your ex in a co-parenting situation. It can really complicate things when people are thinking of each other in terms of who they are to each other. So if I'm co-parenting and I'm thinking about my co-parent as my ex, and I'm calling him my ex and thinking of him as my ex, I am associating him with our relationship, which has a whole lot of baggage and all kinds of things that have absolutely nothing to do with our co-parenting relationship. So it's really important to start to think of your co-parent as my child's other parent, my parenting partner, my co-parent, and not identify them with the old, you know, marital relationship. And so that's the number one place to start, is how you're thinking about this person, how you're identifying them. The other thing is to have some common goals if you can. If you know that you're both aligned on something that you want for your children, that you want them to come through this divorce process unscathed, you're using that. You can measure against that. Well, is this helping us to get closer to that goal? If we're having a fight in front of the kids, are they going to be able to come through this unscathed? No, we can both have that check in and say, okay, no, we know that we want to divert. Sometimes when co-parenting relationships are just way too contentious, it is important to set some more solid boundaries and more structure and move to more of a a parallel parenting situation in that case, where there's just a whole lot of space in between homes and the parents really don't talk much unless it's, you know, an absolute emergency. But otherwise, it's kind of a you do you situation.
You mentioned sometimes children will play their parents against each other to get what they want. What do you do if it's the opposite? What if your co-parent is using your child to get back at you, to either turn their opinion against you or get them to pick a side in the divorce almost?
That's really hard. It's unfortunate. It does happen. And depending on how broken that relationship between parent and child becomes, there are some resources out there. But it's important for parents to be able to talk to each other, to be able to create a healthy relationship between the two of them where they honor each other. And so the more that you can do from the outset to be able to cultivate that, the better you're going to be set up. Once those things start to happen and parents start to speak negatively about the other parent to their children, it's important for the parent who's doing the bad mouthing to remember that their children are biologically composed of both parents. Mm-hmm. And so if you're bad mouthing your child's other parent, indirectly, you're bad mouthing your child. You're telling them that part of them is wrong. And for the parent who's on the receiving end, it's important not to respond in the same way.
To bring things back to the personal, emotional recovery side of things, this could apply to all relationships, really, and not just divorce. But how is recovery different when infidelity or betrayal is involved? How do you work on being able to trust again?
Therapy is great. And therapy is always great, but it's especially great if there's been a betrayal. So it's really important for somebody who has been through an infidelity to make sure that they're getting the kind of emotional support that they need. You know, it can be really hard to experience that because there's a lot of second guessing. There's a lot of just thinking, you know, oh, what? Why wasn't I good enough? And taking it personally. It's important to remember, you know, that the infidelity was a symptom of a problem. There was something wrong with the relationship. It's not one person's fault. There's all kinds of rabbit holes that you can go down. But it's important to look at it and be able to say, this is not my fault. I didn't deserve this. And be able to get the help that you need. Mm-hmm. It can be really hard to recover from that in a healthy way. It does help you to learn things about, you know, red flags and what do healthy relationships look like. And if you knew that there was an infidelity happening or you were always guarding against the infidelity, were you not able to be your authentic self in the relationship? And that's a big wake up call for a lot of people because, well, I needed to be the perfect wife because otherwise he would cheat. That's just no way to live. So that's important too. A lot of people do struggle though, you know, come out of it and say, you know, I'll never love again. I'll never trust again. And that's just not a healthy way to live your life. And so I always encourage people to make sure that they are healing appropriately. Again, with the emotional wounds and physical wounds, same thing, get the care that you need so that you can heal in the right way.
Well, lastly, are there any myths about divorce that you'd like to dispel for us?
I would love to dispel the myth that divorce is a bad thing. It's not. In our culture, we tend to prize marriage and despise divorce. And we think of divorce as this problem that needs to be solved. And what can we do to force people to stay together? And the fact is that people change and relationships change. And especially in the world that we live in now, it's really easy for people to change and relationships to change. And that's okay. When that happens, there's no shame in saying, hey, you know, two adults can find more happiness and more authenticity and even a better relationship between themselves if they're no longer married and their family can be healthier and even more whole because of it.
Tara Eisenhardt is a divorce coach based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Her book is The D Word, Divorce Through a Child's Eyes. You can learn more about that and her work in general at TaraEisenhardt.com. Tara, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. And our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. A big thanks to Katie Hood, Kelly Owens, and Tara Eisenhardt for sharing their time with us this week. To learn more about our guests and the show, check us out at our flagship station's website. That's wamcpodcast.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jessie King from 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house I could have been like. Where are you taking me? Where are you taking me? They said,